Hey guys, welcome back for another episode of the Daily Real Estate Investor Podcast. We're going to do something a little bit different today. It's with a heavy heart that I share the news that my good friend, close friend, Rick Jarman passed away yesterday from COVID complications. This news hit me like a ton of bricks. I was really down about it yesterday because I love the guy. He was just a light in this world, and he made a difference. He made a difference in my life, and he made a difference in a lot of other people's lives. And I came to know him through my real estate podcast, and I had him on my real estate podcast. And I'm going to share that episode with you today, which is one of my favorite episodes. But I also want to tell you a little bit of a story about Rick, some things that, you know, nobody would have known about. They're kind of behind the scenes things, but I had Rick on my podcast, absolutely loved his interview. And then, he and I kept up and we talk on the phone, and he was building his social media thing. And we would talk about ways to grow your social media following and grow a podcast. And he was aspiring to write a book, and he had read my book, and, he was always just very supportive. And after our episode, I told him, you know, I'd been on Bigger Pockets, and I told him, I'm going to recommend you to the producer of the Bigger Pockets podcast, because I really think that everyone there would love you. You're a very entertaining and incredible person. And I think that episode really resonated. He said that had always been on his bucket list. And I got in touch with the producer of Bigger Pockets and recommended him. And the producer of Bigger Pockets came over to my podcast and listened to this episode with Rick and said that they wanted to have him on the show. And Rick called me and was just ecstatic. I mean, he said, "You don't believe how much this means to me. This was my goal for getting on social media and doing the whole thing. And my goal was to be on Bigger Pockets one day. And I've accomplished one of my bucket list items." And it just really felt good to me to have been able to help someone reach one of their goals. And he did the Bigger Pockets interview, which was really great. And you can also go check that out. But and he called me, he on the Bigger Pockets interview, he said he wanted to thank Josiah Smeltzer for helping him get on there, which really really speaks to his heart. He's just a really kind and loving person. And then he called me after his episode and thanked me again. And and then when coronavirus happened, he called me about all the different options for our businesses and how we could strategize and make it through this whole thing, and with all the loan options that were out there and different things like that. And we kept up. And less than a week ago, I was texting him about how he was doing, and he was texting me back and being positive and stuff. And then I got the news. I sent him a message yesterday morning at about 7:30 a.m. asking how he was, and he didn't respond. And then Mark, his good friend, said he passed away at 10:30 a.m. So super heavy heart. But in honor of Rick, I wanted to share this episode with him today. Rick, we love you, man. You were a light in this world. I know you're with God, and I know everyone's going to really enjoy this episode. Let's dive in. Welcome to the Daily Real Estate Investor Podcast. I'm your host, Josiah Smeltzer. The Daily Real Estate Investor Podcast is the shared journey of building a real estate investment property business from square one. Join me as we learn together how to conquer the real estate game to reach financial freedom. Together, we will learn from people in all areas of real estate and business in our personal trek towards escaping the rat race. Be you. Do the work you love. Play the long game. What's up, Daily Real Estate Investor people? We're back with another great episode of the podcast. And today we've got Rick Jarman, Real Estate Old School on Instagram. This guy makes a lot of great content, and he is an investing veteran. Guy's got over 100 houses, nearly all paid off, worth around $10 million, and he's done it old school. slow and steady wins the race in this game. And this guy's gonna impart a lot of wisdom here for you guys in your investing journey. I'm excited to share this episode with you, but first, I've got some really great news. My book is out on Amazon, and I'm so excited to share it with you. I would love for you to go pick up a copy. The digital version is there to purchase on Kindle, and the physical version is being shipped to Amazon as we speak. The physical version should be available anytime. I'm going to give you a sneak peek on the book here with the first page of the book. I'm going to read this first few pages to you so you can get a sneak peek on the book. But the book is called Dream It and Build It: How to Crush Your Real Estate Investing Goals. Each of us are on a journey, even though our journeys are different. My goal was to achieve financial freedom through real estate investing. And if you picked up this book, your interest is likely the same. Financial freedom can come in all shapes and sizes depending on your life goals, such as freedom to do work you love, freedom to quit your 9-to-5, having enough money to retire when you would like, having enough money to travel, having enough money to give freely, etc. We are all created differently, and therefore we'll use our talents in different ways to reach our different goals. I own no real estate and was debt-free when I started with little investment capital. I partnered 50-50 with my best friend who had some money saved and wanted someone with knowledge and hustle to help him build a real estate investment portfolio. My partner and I created an audacious goal. We wanted to buy 10 properties worth a total of $2 million at 75% loan to value in 12 months using the BRRRR strategy. BRRRR stands for buy, rehab, rent, refinance, and repeat. We took massive action and instead acquired 15 properties worth roughly $3 million in only 12 months using a value-add investing strategy. Here's the crazy part. We have a lender that will refinance his portfolio at 80% loan to value, which allows us to get all our investment capital back. My partner contributed our initial investment capital, and we now have $900,000 in equity in our cash flowing rental properties. At 80% loan to value, we have none of our own capital locked in and 20% equity, or $600,000 in equity in a $3 million cash flowing portfolio. How do we do it? It all comes down to mindset, a refusal to quit, and an intentional way of approaching investing. This book was written over the past 12 months as my partner and I built our $3 million real estate portfolio. Each entry is written as a reflection on what I observed in both my investing business as well as fellow investors' businesses. There are formulas and numbers sprinkled throughout, but the book is not meant to be a formulaic textbook. 95% of your real estate investing results will come from your mindset. And this book was written for that very purpose, to get your mind right. My goal is to arm you for success and support you on this journey. You need three things to successfully build a real estate portfolio. And you only have to possess one of the three to bring value. You can partner to fill in gaps with the two you don't possess. Here are the three things: hustle, money, and knowledge. But my specific story is irrelevant to you because your journey will be different than mine. And comparing what you have to others is a losing proposition. Whether you have no real estate or have billions in real estate, this book is for you. This book is meant to help you find peace in the chaos, to feel settled in as the problems come streaming in, because they will. Real estate is a problem-solving game, and a beautiful one at that. The joy is in the journey. And by adopting a peaceful mindset, you can not only accomplish your financial goals and achieve financial freedom, but you can do it in an incredibly fun and comfortable way. Hope these words inspire you to keep trying. Don't quit. Don't lose heart. Your freedom is right on the other side of these obstacles. And as Ryan Holiday wrote, the obstacle is the way. Do it and do it your way and find peace in your quest. Let's go. So that's the first chapter in the book. And the book is Dream It and Build It: How to Crush Your Real Estate Investing Goals. Go over to Amazon, get a copy, and leave me a review. I would be so grateful if you would also leave me a review. That really helps me a lot. And yeah, so without further ado, let's dive into this this interview with Rick Jarman. I'm super excited to have Rick. I met him through Instagram, and his Instagram handle is real_estate_old_school, real estate old school. And man, Rick has a lot of great experience to share with you and with me here on the podcast. And Rick, I'm super excited to have you, man.
Well, man, I'm glad to be here. It's like I always tell folks, I'd rather be here with you than the best jail in Tuscaloosa.
Rick is out of Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and I live in Huntsville, Alabama. And we discovered that Rick knows some of my extended family down there in Tuscaloosa. I've got my grandfather grew up in Tuscaloosa, and we're big Crimson Tide fans. And Rick was telling me that he lives a couple doors down from Nick Saban. So we got to get Nick Saban to get old Tua to come back next year, Rick.
Yeah, we do, man. We do. Yeah, buddy.
Well, Let's dive into this.
If we don't, I don't think my wife will be able to live through it.
Yeah, no kidding. I think he's got a good chance coming back. Of course, we don't know as of the recording of this podcast, we don't know what his decision is, but I think he's got a good chance coming back. So
that's right. I hope so.
I hope so too. Well, so Rick, let's hear about your story about how you got started. And I was talking to Rick a little while ago. Rick has 100 investment properties, which is incredible. And Rick's a very humble guy, and he puts a lot of good content out about how to build your real estate investment portfolio. But and there's a lot of people that talk a lot, and there's a lot of fluff out there. But you've actually done this. So, kind of share with us how you got going and your story and stuff, and give us some advice on how to do the same thing if we're wanting to go the same route you did.
Okay. Well, I'll start at the very beginning. When I was 3 years old, my dad had a complete mental breakdown. He was a World War II veteran, and he was in the VA hospital till I was 15 years old. And he had a new house, new car, you know, the American dream. This is in the 50s because I'm 64 years old. And when he got sick, I don't know if they sold the house or lost it and sold the car. My mom didn't have a job, didn't drive, you know. And I didn't know this about 3 years ago. My brother was telling me, he's 6 years older now, that we were homeless for about, 9 months to a year. Our family was split up. Me and my mother lived with one of our sisters and my brother with another sister. So we were raised, it was tough times, and we was raised to work. So hard work's what I knew. But my mother always instilled in us that anything was possible. You know, we put our bitches' legs on one leg at a time, just like everybody else. And she taught us, you know, to work hard. And my parents, they rented houses, you know, because they couldn't buy, you know. So I was always, you know, taught to, you want to own your own place one day, you know. So that was a big thing for me. So when I was, senior in high school, I met my future wife, and we were engaged and all, and I'm fixing to get out of high school, and I'd worked all my life, so I paid down on a piece of land. Got the guy to owner finance it, $500 down. I put a septic tank on it and a mobile home, and all we had to do was wait on me to get out of high school. So that was 1973, so I've been married going on 47 years. And that was my first dose of real estate. But I actually met my wife playing in her brother's band. I was playing music six nights a week at the Mata Inn when I was a senior in high school. So I didn't learn a lot, but I was having a good time. But getting married, I knew I would have changed my lifestyle. Of course, my wife was a church pianist, and there I was playing in the honky-tonks. So I quit that and got a job at a cabinet shop right when I graduated from high school. And all my life, you know, I had enjoyed anytime anybody was doing something in my neighborhood, building something, whatever, I'd be down there in the way. And my 11th and 12th grade of high school, I got a job working, did my first construction work with a girl I went to school with. His dad he was a home builder. And I worked for him that summer, and I knew right then, you know, I'd found what I want to do the rest of my life, and I've been blessed that, you know, that's pretty much what I've been able to do. And, you know, I told you the story one day we was talking earlier about when I went to work in the cabinet shop, I had just turned 18. So, you know, I'm green as a cucumber. And one day we're on break and they're talking and something was said. And, you know, I said, well, you know, I won't build houses one day. And they got a chuckle out of that. It wasn't like they were trying to be mean. I guess they just, here I am learning how to sand stuff, just doing labor work, you know, and I'm talking about wanting to build houses, and it struck them kind of funny. Well, you know, fast forward, I left the cabinet shop within a couple of months, got in on this labor on a union job, went from there to got into carpenter apprentice and went on to doing work on the side, come a carpenter, got out to university. I was in maintenance for 10 years out there. And during that time, I was putting my wife through college and started, you know, flipping houses. And by 1981, I'd bought my first rental. We actually bought our first house in 1976. We bought it, moved in it, flipped it, did that two or three times till we got to where we, you know, had a good deal on the house and had enough equity. We were sitting pretty. But that's kind of how I got started, you know, a little story back about the cabinet shop. They was on break, you know, I told you about, they kind of laughed at me, hurt my feelings a little bit, and they didn't think nothing about it. But fast forwarded, I went full time in business for myself in 1984, building houses and remodeling, flipping everything. Well, I was building so many houses by, I guess it would have been 20 years later from when I worked at the cabinet shop. It had been 1993. So I was working there in 1973. My cabinet man couldn't keep up with the amount of houses I was building, so I had to hire another cabinet man. And you can guess who I hired. I hired the guy I used to work for. And I never said nothing about it because he probably didn't think anything about it. But every time I'd sign that check to him for a set of cabinets, I'd think about it.
Yeah. It's funny how somebody overlooking you or discounting you and your dreams can just sit in your crawl, you know, and and motivate you. There's a number of different types of motivation. And, you know, I have some people in my life that I think about that, you know, I said something like, I want to be a real estate investor and I want to write a book one day. And they just kind of, you know, almost laughed in my face, you know? And, I remember that stuff, and it's not like I'm not angry with them, but I use that as motivation to go out there. And, you know, I remember Jerry Seinfeld said something one time about dealing with people that are, you know, basically giving him anything but love. He said, the best way you can deal with that is just live your life well, you know, live your life well, just go out there and work hard and live your life well. And that's the very best thing you can do. Like, don't do anything to spite those people. Just go out there and live your life well. And that's the best way to combat that. So I really like that. So, you know, I think about those folks sometimes and I use that as motivation. And, you know, you did the same thing. And it's ironic how they're laughing at you one second, next second you're writing them, you know, a check for because you hired them. Well, so
it might have been 20 years, but by golly, I hadn't forgot it at the time.
Yeah.
but you know, I guess I'm a little different. A lot of people you probably have on here, my career spans so long. I mean, it's kind of hard, you know, for me to pick out things and I might get sidetracked, you know, but it's been a good industry I've been in. And, you know, like I said, I was a home builder. In 2015, I quit building houses. I turned 60 that year. And actually, it was in May when my birthday was. I got up one morning and I said, I'm through. I'm not building any more houses. And I built close to 500 in my career. And, you know, that's, we'd take them one time for whatever the economy called for. If we need to remodel, we would remodel, you know. And it's just, and the rental, we were continuously buying rentals, you know, the whole time. And, you know, that was the main goal is to get enough rentals because, when I was putting my wife through college and I worked at the university in maintenance, I mean, like, what better training? Because I worked in housing in the dorms, you know, rental property. I never worked in the classrooms. I had this man that I did a lot of side work on his rentals. And that's when it really hit me that, you know, this is where it's at, you know. I mean, you know, I'm thinking he doesn't have the headaches. I'm going down there doing work. I mean, I know that wasn't so, but through my eyes is a young man, that's what I was seeing. But I could see where he lived and how he lived, and I knew, you know, the rental property had got him there. So that's really what kind of got me interested in the rentals. And then I guess it would have been about 1980, right before I bought my first rental house. There was an article, I'm going to date myself. It was in Reader's Digest magazine. It was called Beating Inflation with Real Estate. And I read an article, and by this time, you know, I got two kids or one and one on the way or something. And my mother asked me, said, what would you like for Christmas? And there was three books listed in this article. And I said, I'd like to get these three books. And they were the first three books I ever bought on real estate. And to this day, I keep them on the, in my bedroom, you know, between a couple bookends up on a piece of furniture there where I can see them every day. And, you know, and I know that's where it all started.
Well, tell us which three books those were.
Okay. One of them was called Beating Inflation. Well, no, it's named the article. I'm sorry. One of them was called William Nickerson. It's by William Nickerson. It's called How I Turned $500 into a Million. Later on, they had to update it because he'd have new issues and he was worth more. But this guy would probably be the granddaddy of all the books. I've never heard of anybody that had a book that was older than this one. He originally, had written it in the 60s. And a lot of this stuff is just like today. That's why I always tell folks, you know, real estate doesn't change. It's everything else, financing and whatever. The second book was called, it was by Albert J. Lowry. And it was, I'm trying to remember the title of it. You'd think I could just tell you, but I may have to go get them in a minute or have my wife bring them in here.
Yeah, we can come back to it. It's no problem.
Yeah, and the third one was a guy by the name Robert Allen, who's still out there, and it was called Beating Inflation with Real Estate. That was the name of his. And the strange thing about it, two of those three authors end up going busted because they got away from what they were doing and got into spas and different things, you know. You know, back spas was real big, you know, in the 90s and whatever. But old William Nickerson, he just kept on clicking along.
Yeah, I haven't seen any books titled Beating Inflation with Spas, you know.
That's right.
But that's actually one reason I love real estate investing is you can beat inflation with real estate investing if you're investing in the right areas. So you're beating inflation, so your money is compounding. Your money's not being eroded away like it will if you just let it sit in the bank. You're beating, right. You're beating inflation. You're paying your debt down. The thing is appreciating in value, and you've got cash flow left over after you pay your debts and all your operating expenses if you're doing it right. And as long as you're beating inflation, it means you're buying in the right areas. And that's the name of the game. That's how people create real wealth. And you've obviously done this very well. And so I'm curious, how are you able to end up building a portfolio of 100 single family houses? Because we have about 3.5 million in single family houses, and that's about 15 properties. And it's a lot, right. It's a lot to keep up with, but you have a lot more than we do. And we have all ours managed by property managers and all that, but it's still a lot to keep up with. So I know you're keeping up with a whole lot. How have you built your system out to take care of these 100 properties, and how long did it take you to acquire these?
Well, I will share something with you. In the late 90s, let me tell you this. I left the university. I was in 1984. I had just turned 29. I wasn't 29 a month. By 1993, I was worth close to $2 million. That's a lot of money in that time, you know.
That's a lot of money now.
Yeah. But then by 1998, I had to start over. It wasn't nothing to do with my rentals. My rentals were my salvation. At that time, I probably had 35 houses, a 10-unit apartment complex, a 16-unit apartment complex. And I'd gotten into trouble just like Donald Trump. If you read, you know, the Art of the Comeback, all this was about the same time. And I got just focusing on construction, a lot of speculative. And, you know, there was nothing out there teaching you this stuff. And that's why I get so nervous now about a lot of the young guys investing I see out here. You know, you get to thinking you got the golden touch and nothing, because everything you touch just works. And all of a sudden, no matter what, you know, like I would, we were stuck out there with like 20-something new houses. Interest rate went through the roof. No matter how good a house you build, you couldn't sell them, you know, and it really got tough. And I basically had to sell all my houses off and start over. So basically, I did it since I was 43. But, oh, wow. You know, it's a lot easier second time around.
Yeah. So, were you able to unload all those houses without going into foreclosure on any of them?
Yeah, I didn't have any going to foreclosure.
That's an accomplishment in and of itself.
I found out about a term that you don't hear much. It's called phantom income. It's when you sell off a piece of real estate and you sell it less than the market value because you're like a fire sale. You know, you're selling things off, trying to get all you can, take care of folks. The government looks at what it's really worth and they tax you on money you didn't even make. Phantom income. Trust me, you don't want to know about phantom income.
It sounds like something that a lot of people are chasing.
Oh man, I can tell you a lot of things, but man, it's just because it's been a lifetime, you know.
Sure.
But sure. So you know, basically in '98, I started back. And that's when I really got serious on my rentals again, you know, when I didn't take my eye off the ball and just, because I loved construction, see. But the thing about construction, just like in 2008 when this recession hit, I didn't get hurt. You know, I didn't make the money I was making, but I was able to pull back because I'd learned my lessons. And, you know, basically, you know, in 1998, I'd been learning what to do and not to do. And I was, me and three or four others here, only a few builders that survived. That here in Tuscaloosa, it got tough. But I just bought like $1.4 million worth of building lots and I had to work through that. But so if you take from 1998, basically when I had to start over, and then you had recession in 2008, which that slowed things some, you know. I wasn't buying, you know, you couldn't. I bought a few things. I had a guy that was a private money lender that I was able to buy some deals that I knew I wouldn't keep. But that I would sell, you know, when things picked up again. And so I tell folks my net worth went up $2 million after the recession because I was able to pick up some deals. But then, you remember, in 2011, we had a bad tornado here in Tuscaloosa.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I lost 26 houses totaled and had damage to about 70-something others. So I had like a $2 million insurance claim. So that was another setback, you know, but we were insured, you know, and, you know, people say, well, you had insurance. They say, yeah, but, you know, you lose that income. You got to buy property up again. It's a lot of hard work. It took us 3 years to get everything collected from the insurance companies and, you know, get our houses back up, you know. So I had a goal years ago, when I first started out, I said, one day I want to own 200 houses and be worth $12 million. And they say, how'd you come up with that goal? Well, back then, the average rent was about $600. I took $600, so that's 200 houses, that's $12 million. And I don't know if I'll hit the 200 houses before I retire. All this is what I want for retired, you know, but I may work that other number out. We'll just have to see if I can go a few more years.
Wow. So you have 100 houses and they're worth what approximately each one on average?
Oh, the average house would be probably 85 to 100. I mean, I have some that's worth, you know, 160 and some that's worth 75, 85, you know.
Sure. So the portfolio is worth around 10 million.
Yeah, about 10 and a half million.
That's incredible. So, and you said you were using a private money lender, but you said you basically started over in the late 90s and built this, you know, so we'll say 2000 for the sake of round numbers. So you built this in about 20 years.
Right.
That's a really quick pace. And I'm sure you're probably buying more of these on the front end of that than the back end. Coming from someone who did, you know, we did about 15 deals last year. How are you able to float the purchase, the renovation, the refinance, the repairs while doing multiple deals at once? How are you able to pull all that off? Because it requires a lot of cash.
It does. Here's what I did when I was starting over. I read a book called Master Builder by Trammell Crow. I recommend that book. I mean, it may not affect everybody like it did me. But I don't know if you're familiar with Trammell Crow. You know, he got caught up in, he was in a lot of commercial stuff. And he got caught up in commercial turned down in real estate, probably, I guess it could have been the late 90s also or somewhere. But anyway, he was on track to be the richest man in the United States instead of Sam Walton. He had these setbacks, but he overcame them, whatever. But I mean, his companies are still out there. He's passed on, but he has like Lincoln Properties and a lot of these companies. He was a pioneer in the markets, you know, like out in Texas, like where people come and bring their stuff and set up. Like people go to Atlanta, you know, to the market or to New York. He brought a lot of that. But anyway, back to your question. I'm sorry I got sidetracked. I worked with partners. That's something he did. He had it. You look in there, it was like almost like a spider web. He's in the center and everybody's his partners, but none of them are connected. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
And so I was like that when I started over. When I was still building, I had partners, you know, because what I would do, I had attorneys, accountants, and appraisers that knew me and I was partners with. And we'd have LLCs set up, I mean, real companies. And they would bring the money and I would do the talent bill, you know, because I'm also a broker and I have a real estate company. And so we'd do all that. Well, that freed me up that I didn't have to have the money to keep the houses going. I could take my money when I sold a house and put it into rental. You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
So I was doing that. And I had a partner in some of my rentals when I started over in the rentals. And he got caught up in the recession 2008. He was an electrician. That was my electrician, still a good friend of mine. And he and I probably owned 50-something houses together at one time. And I bought him out because, you know, the recession got him. Because he, you know, he got off into things besides his electrical. And he'd been okay if his company could have pulled it off. But when everybody quit building, because see, if you're in this business full-time like I was as a builder and got caught up in the 90s, nowhere for money to come in unless you sell a house. And if houses quit selling, then you know, of course, back then, your rentals were just like a lot of people, you know, you're just paying for them, making a little cash flow. But I would have had 35 houses and all that stuff, and I ain't paid off when I turned 50. But wow. As it is now, you know, but I always do 15-year note stuff. So
interesting.
We have our debts low on our stuff, and I don't have any partners on my real estate, on my rentals, except my accountant and I, who is my nephew. We own 4 houses together. Then my son and I have 24 houses together, 26. Gotcha.
So you ended up either buying out or refinancing out all of those partners. And now you pretty much own the lion's share of all this yourself.
Oh, yeah.
Counted in on 4 of them. So
most of my partners were in, except for the one I bought out on the 50-something houses, were in the construction side of the building, you know.
Gotcha. So tell us how you were able to acquire these and get these rented. You're doing them with partners. They're fronting the money. You're basically the operator. What was your process for doing this starting at zero?
Well, like I said, I only had basically one partner on the rentals and I would take my money, but I would spend, I've always been a hard worker, but I would spend like, you know, I used to kid folks telling me I was semi-retired. I'd cut back to 10-hour days. In reality now, it's about 6 hours or 7 with a good hour lunch break. But to answer your question, I would spend 20 hours a week looking at real estate, you know, besides my job, a minimum of 20 hours. And I had like one guy bought 9 houses and a 5-plex from. I had another guy bought 7 houses. And then a lot of them were just buying them at foreclosures, you know. And I could have probably grown my portfolio even more after the recession, except, like I said, I was dealing with a bunch of lots with the banks in 2008. And so I wasn't able to jump out and get a lot of the deals. Of course, the banks, see, when you're a builder, you're borrowing that money. I didn't have partners at this point, but maybe one. So you borrow money to build houses, well, the bank's only going to loan you so much money. You know, they're going to loan you money to build houses to buy rentals. So there I am with them lots. I'm going to get them going. But if I hadn't been with the private money lender, I was able to pick up a lot of good deals after the recession. But that's what worries me now about a lot of guys I see now. They've never seen anything but these great times. And don't take this wrong, But I tell people all the time, in the market we're in right now, a blind man could do it. it's a good market. It's simple. It's hard. I mean, but money's free. Property, you know, you can find property to rent. You know, it's look. Right now, the problem is most people, it's a seller's market. It's hard to find deals.
Yep.
But now, I would love to see it just get normal again. It hasn't been a normal market since 2008.
I started investing in 2004, and that was an abnormal time as well, because you remember that. I mean, 2004 to 2000, you know, beginning of 2008, and I was out in Dallas, Fort Worth, and it was just mania in investing and refinancing. And, you know, I started learning investing at that point, and I was an appraiser. And so I was getting appraisal orders all the time for, you know, investment properties, people wanting to refi, and, you know, lending regulations have changed since then. And so has the regulations around appraisals and stuff. But a lot of the appraisers went out of business because, you know, these people would call an appraiser and say, "Hey, I'm looking for this value. Can you get this or not?" And the appraiser would say, "Yeah, I can do that." And then they would, you know, and so they're doing these unethical appraisals. Well, we would just say, "Hey, that's not how this works."
Oh, yeah.
You know, we can't, that's not how this works. We're just going to appraise it for what it's worth. And they would hang up the phone and go call somebody else. So thankfully we did things the right way and we never had any problems, but a lot of appraisers they went out of business and they lost their licenses for doing stuff like that. And that's why I think a lot of appraisers now are gun shy about actually putting a real accurate value on a property, because they're worried that they're going to get sued later and they're tiptoeing around being super conservative. And I just try to appraise it for what it's worth. That's always my goal. But anyway, I started investing back then. I was also doing appraisal work, and I kind of saw the writing on the wall. I remember telling some of my friends, this just can't keep going on. I mean, these properties are going up in value so fast and people are buying them with almost no money down. And it just seems like a blind man could do it. Well, then 2008 happened and the market, the market just came to a halt almost, and there was all these builders and vacant houses for sale that weren't selling, and foreclosure issues. And so I lived through that. And luckily I had just kind of dumb luck sold my properties, because I was going to go hike the Appalachian Trail and then go back to school. I sold my properties right before all that happened, so I never had any problems with it, but I watched it from the sidelines. And I wish I hadn't sold those properties now, you know, because I didn't do it because I was worried about the market. I just did it because I had a lot of money there and was going to go to school and go hike the Appalachian Trail and everything. Right. I wasn't married. Anyway, I saw that. So, you know, I've got that in the back of my mind right now, because one day it was great and the next day it wasn't going on at all. And so I at least have that. But there's some investors now that they've just invested in this really good time period, and they have no idea that the market can tank.
Don't get me wrong, I'm not a gloom and doom type guy, but I'm like you. You know, I bought a foreclosure before the recession. That was probably 2005, 2006, 2007, whatever, when everything was just, well, you know, back then you could buy a piece of property. The bank would loan you 80% of the appraisal, not the purchase price, you know, the appraisal, you know, after your repairs and stuff. I mean, you're getting in zero down, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And we're still, you know, but I bought this one house, had an extra lot. I built a house on the lot, and I remodeled the house and sold it. Well, the guy that bought the house, he had a first, second, and third mortgage on a $59,000 or $69,000 house.
Oh, my.
I mean, his transmission went out. He was going to lose it, which he did lose it. But it wasn't going to do with me. I'm just selling. You know, I wasn't his agent or his, you know, loan officer. But you know what was happening? They were thinking everybody deserved to have a house, whether they qualified or not. And we, you know, I like to tell folks, go and watch The Big Short. To me, that's
I love that movie. Yeah.
Well, see, I hadn't even touched on this, but I had a bond issue, and you know, I did a swap, and that's what that was about. You know, on the swap, you know, you for the bond issue, you pay your interest quarterly and your principal once a year. And when you do the swap, you pay for a fixed rate. And I had a fixed rate for like 5 years for 4.5%. And all of a sudden, I get a letter saying my rate went up about 8.5%. I think, how could this be, you know? But I can't talk about it a lot because I'm under a gag order. So I'd tell you right there, you know, if the bank was trying to do something wrong. But You know, so I've experienced a lot of things, you know, in that. But, you know, my salvation was my rentals, because they never once did the bank call and say, hey, we want you to, you know, turn them houses in. You know, that's why I tell folks, if you buy affordable houses that you can keep rented, no matter what the market is, if times get hard, then people going to keep paying rent, even if they had to, two, three families move in. You know what I'm saying? They're going to keep paying.
So let's talk about, let's talk about that. So let's talk about 2008 and 2009. How many properties did you own going into that time period?
Oh, pretty much what I got now. You got to realize I lost 20 something after that. So I had to build back up, because I'm actually running about 120, be truthful right now.
Gotcha. So you had about 100 properties going into 2008.
Yeah, so I was basically the same way. Now you got to realize 2008 was 11 years ago, almost 12. So
sure.
I wasn't as far down the pipe with them as I am now.
Sure, you know? Sure. So you're in, what do you think your debt was on average on these properties? Let's say they're worth, you know, at the time, maybe they're worth 80 on average. How much debt do you think you had on each one?
Oh, God, I don't know. It was probably.
You said you put them on 15-year notes, so maybe.
Yeah,
maybe
I always do 15-year notes.
50 or 60 a piece or something.
Yeah. I'll give you a good example. I had a loan that I had 55 houses on, and I moved it from where I had it to a new place. I financed $1,550,000. I paid $500,000 down, financed $1,550,000, because that, when I bought my partner out, you know, that was the 50 something house, see. So I bought him out, moved the note. Well, today on that loan, and when I did that, they were like at 36% loan to value. That was about 8 years ago. So today I'm at $800,000 on. I sold two houses, I refinanced four, and then they released five because I was complaining about the flood insurance. And, you know, and I told them I was going to move the loan. They didn't want to lose that loan, because, I mean, so today, so you take 55 minus the four, 51. Anyways, it's 48 houses on that note now, and I owe $800,000 just to fuzz under. So that's where I'm at on that big note. A lot of others, you know, are paid way. My son and I, we have stuff down in the 20s, you know, and
sure,
we're sitting good on that.
So you go into the reset, you basically go into 08, you've got about 100 houses, you've got, or let's say they're worth on average 80, and you're in them for, it's looking like, you know, 50 or 60 or something like that.
Yeah, that's right.
And what were these on average renting for at the time?
Oh, you know, a lot of my stuff is Section 8, so it doesn't go up like a lot of things, because you get a good tenant, you don't want to get them out. So a lot of them were renting basically, you know, back then, $700, $750, yeah. You know, $775.
And we've talked about Section 8 on my podcast before, but real quick, run us through how Section 8 works for those listeners who aren't familiar with it.
Well, I love Section 8. You know, people, they think Section 8, they think slumlords and stuff like that, and that's not so. You can take, way it works, you get a certificate. That person gets a certificate. And they could go rent $1 million house if that person was willing to rent that $1 million house to them for what that certificate's for. So somebody comes to me, they've got a certificate that says it's an $850 certificate. I've got a house rent for $850. The government subsidizes, pays part of their rent. In other words, sometimes they pay all of it, some of it half. It's all based on their income, how many children, that kind of thing. The whole idea of Section 8 is for them to work off of it and stand on their own, you know. But in my 30 years of dealing with it, or however long it's been around, I think I've been dealing about 30 years, Section 8. I've only known two people to work off of it, and that's within the last couple of years. So, you know, in theory, they're supposed to work off of it, but it doesn't happen. But what it does for you, like, you know, our rents run around $70,000 a month gross. Well, I get a check from Section 8, one from Norport, for about $15,000. I get one from Tuscaloosa for about about 30,000, 32, something like that. Just depends on, you know, varies and some bacon or whatever. So the rest of the money I get from the tenants. Now, not all of my stuff's Section 8, but I'm just talking about the ones that are Section 8. So now you've got to deal with some government stuff, but hey, if it's easy, everybody do it. But, you know, you learn what they look for. You keep your houses up, which we do that anyway. We have a full-time maintenance man, and, you know, it works good for us. And we had an inspector a while back that was really making everybody's life, you know, hard. My son was talking about some of the guys that we're a member of the Home Builder Association. Some of the guys at the association, I'm like, man, I'm not going to rent Section 8 anymore, like the Tuscaloosa and Northport. My son was telling me, I said, well, son, you know, that's fine. That's just more for us. You know, you just, where, you know, I'm in a town that's student rentals. I don't like student rentals because, like I said, I worked at the university for 10 years that with students. It's just not my thing. I have sold off all my student rentals. And I didn't have that many, but I mean, what I had, I sold off. I like Section 8. I've specialized in that. You know, I stay up on it, and it works good for me. Even when the government shut down, our checks kept coming.
That's great. So what percentage-wise, you said most of your portfolio was Section 8, not all. Going into 08, what percentage of your portfolio was Section 8 rentals?
Going into 08, I would say 85%.
So, I mean, that's probably a good reason that you weathered that storm so well, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you're getting a check from the government for your rental properties. And you're, you know, I mean, as long as the government's cutting you a check, you're able to pay your bills. So that's, that's about as stable as you can get during that time. So,
we were blessed. And here's the thing, like Tuscaloosa, by the 10th of the month, they direct deposit your money. By the 10th of the month, Norfolk mails me a check. I mean, that's hard and sweet.
yeah. So, you know, Section 8 has a reputation of being more difficult to manage. How do you manage this whole portfolio?
Well, you know, I check people here. Well, let me slow down and rethink this for. I've got a video. In fact, folks can go and follow me on Real Estate Old School, like you said. And I do a video every day, and I talk about different things, what I look at to qualify a tenant, whatever. But we check the credit right there in our office. I don't do what people say, what kind of beacon score do you look for? We don't do the beacon score. A lot of people don't realize you can still do old school credit check. It's cheaper. My credit bureau runs me about, I think, $104 a month. It used to be, you know, less than that. It's you know, you, but it, as everything goes up anyway, I mean, I charge a $35 application fee. So, you know, it's not bad. But anyway, I check the credit, and I don't do the beacon score. And it's not even on there. What I look at, it'll show, do they have any judgments? Do they have any, you know, if they're over 30, 90, what they're over? Any collections, any bankruptcies, and you see all these things. Now you got to realize they're not going to be perfect. Because if they're not buying the house, I look, see, okay, if they got medical, I don't get upset about that because a lot of people don't have insurance. If they have school loans they're behind on, I don't worry about that. But now I check two landlords if I can. I want to be sure. But also look and see if they're paying their landlord, if they're paying the power bill, water bill, gas bill, and what other little bills they got, they're going to pay me. That's pretty much it.
Gotcha. So you've got your process ironed out for vetting your tenants. How are you managing this portfolio on a day-to-day basis? Do you have a property management company, or are you doing it yourself? Or
we do it ourselves. I've always managed my own stuff. Back during the 90s, we managed other people's stuff, about 300 units. At one time, I was fourth owner of Coldwell Banker franchise. I mean, I've been a broker since 86 and licensed realtor since 83. Like I said, I went full-time in 84. But building's always been my thing. I have one agent still today. But anyway, to answer your question, I don't mean to be throwing all that out there. I'm just trying to let you know we've just all, you know, this has been my living and what I do, and I love it, you know, all these years. I've been blessed. But anyway, to answer your question, I have a lady that works in my office. She's my bookkeeper, office manager, helps me with the property management. And then my son works, you know, he's been with the company. My son's 38 and he's worked. He graduated high school in 2000. He's a licensed home builder. And, you know, he's worked with the company ever since he come out of school. And he's part owner in the Jarman Construction, Realty and Construction. So between him and me and her, that's how we do it. Now, I don't, in fact, if you watched one of my videos a day or two ago, I don't answer the phone or I don't get it. If I get involved, it ain't good. I mean, if I had to go to their house or talk with them, it's not a good sign because I don't get involved with the day-to-day of that part. I still approve every application, you know, that way if there's ain't nobody can be on but me if it don't work out.
Sure. So you've got your bookkeeping set up with your bookkeeper. You got your property. You got your the person in your office doing the property management and the bookkeeping. Then you've got your son involved, and you're not sitting there. You're not doing all the property management yourself. You're deciding whether to approve or decline applications, and
that's right.
Working on the business instead of in the business, which is how you build and scale. So that's good. So let's see. What's been the biggest headache and hurdle with going this route, with building your portfolio using Section 8? And, you know, what would you give what kind of advice would you give someone who's thinking about doing the same thing?
Well, let's see. I've never been asked that. You know, I don't want this to sound wrong because I've been doing it so long. It's kind of like, old shoe, you know what I mean? You always have changes because things change with the government. I would say the biggest hurdle we've come into now with Section 8 would be the lead-based paint. You know, it's always been, you know, any house built before 1978 has the possibility of lead-based paint. Well, what the government does, if there's a child within that house and that house is less than 6 years old, you have to have a test ran. Now, that test is good for the life of the house, you know. But the only person that can test it here around where I live is somebody at the University of Alabama. It costs about $450. You know, used to, you go to Lowe's, buy a little kit and test if it was, you know, lead-based paint, but you can't do that anymore. So, and also, my son, I don't do it because, you know, I'm at the point I'm not studying anymore, but he stays up. He has to get certified. Lead-based paint certified for our company. Now, we don't go and do abatement. I don't mean that, but just like I say, if we've got some peeling paint in this older house, there's a certain process you have to do, you know, in case it is lead-based paint, and we're trained to do that, and we do it on our property. But I would say that's been the biggest challenge because, you know, you get older houses, it's just you run into that risk, you know.
Sure. What's how long does it typically take you to fill a vacancy on Section 8?
Not, you know, it goes pretty. Our vacancies run really low. You know, we're below what the, you know, I think appraisers, y'all used to figure what 30% or something, you know. But we run way low. I mean, it doesn't take long usually. What'll happen with Section 8, like say I get a house that's empty, tenant moves out, like say they're moving out at the end of this month. Well, then I've got to get it ready to rent again, of course. Well, then if I rent it during that month, I don't prorate, no words. All my rents come due on the first. You know, I mean, I prorate it, but Section 8, you know, I don't, when I go to them, like that person, you know, Section 8, I tell them, okay, their lease is going to start the first of the month. Now, that person can move in before then if they pay me the difference, you know, the prorated amount of rent. But you can't have 100 plus houses coming due all kind of different times of the month. It's got they all, that way you can look on the first, you look on the 10th, you see who's paid, who hasn't paid, and, sure, you know, all that.
Sure.
But way Section 8 to do so, okay, say I'm house is empty the end of this month. I get it ready and I rent it by the middle of next month. Person pays me the, you know, the 15 days. With Section 8, if they can get and check it out in time, you'll get your check the next month. But now for some reason that they're busy and they can't get it done, you may not get your check to the next month, but they'll pay you for both months. They'll, you know, they'll go back and pay you for it.
Sure.
But that's, I mean, it's really, other than dealing with the paperwork of the government, it's just not a lot of negatives to it, as far as I'm concerned.
Is there a way to see what a property would be approved for Section 8 rent-wise before you buy it?
Yeah, I mean, you kind of learn what you're looking at. Like, you can't have a bunch. You remember the old style, which most houses I buy, first thing I do, put central heating air in them if they don't have it.
Sure.
But, you know, you can't have a house that's got non-vented gas heaters, you know. You can't have a bunch of peeling paint. You got to fix all that, you know.
Sure.
All your windows have to open, and, you know, they make sure it's good. You know, it's got to be nice and, you know, livable and safe. You know, that's the big thing with them, health and safety.
Right. What is, like, let's say I'm looking at buying a house that's, you know, $150,000, and I believe it'll rent for $1,500 a month. I'm thinking about going Section 8 on this thing, but I'm not sure what Section 8 will approve rent-wise.
I got you. That would probably be a hard one to make work. You've got a Section 8 only go, like, usually on a four-bedroom, you might get $950 to $1,000.
Okay.
So that's another thing. Like, I have a cutoff point of about $85,000. Used to be $75,000. I had to buy, because the time I fix it up and everything, you know, to make the numbers work. But, you know, your three bedrooms, they usually pay anywhere from $850 to $875. Four bedrooms, nine to, you know, maybe $1,000 max. And two bedrooms, you know, are $550 to $650, $675, maybe $700. And some of your three bedrooms can be as low as $700, because it's all. One thing about Section 8, you could have a 2,000-square-foot house and a 1,000-square-foot house, and they're both three bedrooms. They will pay the same. It doesn't matter about
that's interesting.
Bedrooms, you know?
That's interesting. Well, okay, so I got a couple more questions, and then we'll wrap this up. But what? So you've got this portfolio of 100 properties, around 100 properties, give or take, and you've got most of them rented out on Section 8. You've got them paid down a good bit, almost completely paid off. What are you profiting per month net of operating expenses and debt service?
Operating expenses and net, well,
and debt service, like paying debt. Yeah.
I give you a good example, like that one note I stayed, you know, $800,000 on. That payment's right at $12,000 a month. Well, you take 45 houses and multiply it time average $800, $750. And I tell you right there, just on them, and all of them about the same like that. We do real good with it.
That's great. All right. Well, okay. And my last question on it, what's your exit strategy for owning 100 houses? Are you planning on keeping them and giving them over to your son when you're done? Or are you planning on trying to sell them as a portfolio, sell them one at a time? What do you think?
No, I'll never sell. I mean, I'm at a point with some of them too, that, like, especially after the tornado, that I used up some of the, you know, the depreciation that, you know, keep paying taxes on some of the money, that if I sell them, I'd be hit. So I'd have to do tax-free exchanges, you know.
Sure.
I pay so much taxes. And, my goal's never been to sell them. Sometimes my account, like I said, it's off of my nephew. He said, I just sell all them, pay your taxes, and go home. But, you know, I've tried to build something that's, I have two children, and it's, I want them to have it, and then my grandkids. And, you know, after that, I can, you know, I feel like it'll last through them anyway.
Sure.
And, you know, I'm 64 years old, or 64 and a half. I've got to enjoy making them and doing the work. And, you know, I live good, and I don't know. You know, I really just, sure. I got people that, I've got a lady that sells real estate for me. It's been with me 15 years or better. My maintenance man's been with me about 15, my office manager 8. you know, like I said, my son's been there going, maybe 20 years. So it's kind of like, you know, I think about them too, you know, at times I say, well, I could just shut it down. And because we flip houses too. I don't think I even told you that. We flip 10 to 12 houses a year since I quit building. You know, we started back once, you know, I quit building and Tommy was good enough for good. I just, because I have overhead with an office and staff and whatever, that if we don't generate enough money through the real estate sales and flipping houses, it comes out of my rentals. And I don't like that.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you're flipping houses, cover your overhead. I like that. It's good to have the flipping thing going, even if you're not flipping a ton, just to generate some extra profit to throw in there and cover some of these other expenses. So,
well, like I said, I have a certain price range that the type of house I rent that I can't pay more, but that doesn't mean I don't find a deal that's a good deal that I can fix up and flip.
Sure,
you know,
absolutely.
If it doesn't fit my criteria.
Well, Rick, this has been a really, really informative time, and all this information's been great. I know it's going to really help a lot of investors. Tell us what you found to be the determining factor in an investor's success when they try to become financially free through real estate investing.
Well, you just got to buy them and put them on kind of not on autopilot, but you just got to kind of forget about them. As far as money, just keep paying them off. It's kind of like a savings plan. You know, you just let the tenant pay for it, and you're letting it build, and you're out here doing whatever you do for a living, where flipping houses, working at the plant or whatever. And one day, I believe in 15-year notes, and what'll happen, one day you're going to turn around there and you're going to say, man, you know. I mean, that's like I was telling my wife the other day, that big note, I was trying to make her understand. I said, you realize you're going to have a $12,000 raise a month here for long.
and
but you know what I'm thinking about doing, that was about less than 5 years away, but I'm thinking about taking that $800,000, tie about 10 houses to it, start them over on 15 years, and then I'll have that 34 houses free and clear.
Yeah.
I could do that in 2 months, you know.
Yep. Yeah, that's not a bad idea. I love it. So and you're going to create a massive cash flow machine once these are all paid off. So,
oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean,
your problem is going to be knowing what to do with all your cash. That's going to be your next problem. So,
well, you know, when you gross what we do and that our debt is lower, because, you know, until you pay it off, the payment's basically the same.
Right, exactly.
So you got to stay on top of it and all that.
Yep.
But, you know, one thing a lot of people don't understand, the first rental house I ever bought, and my career is so scattered along, I don't mean to keep jumping back and forth in time, but it was in 1981. I paid $10,000 for it. It's worth about $20,000. Guy was going through a divorce. I sold a pickup truck I had to get money. I went to the credit union. They said they'd finance it. I'd have to pay the closing costs and pay for the repairs. Well, I sold a truck I had to get the money to had a nice Ford pickup truck. Sold it to get money to have fixed up. I bought an old raggedy station wagon. It was a 69 Plymouth Army Green. It had a tailgate folded down like a truck, and I could work out of it. It had a loan value of $1,200. I bought it for $600, so I got another $600 on it. And that's how I bought that first house. And that first house, I refinanced it probably 3 times over the years. And, you know, people don't realize, as you know, when you refinance a house and you borrow that money out, that's tax-free.
I love that. That's one of the best ways to access investment capital with no tax implications is just do a refinance. Of course, there's closing costs involved, but you know, right, you've got a massive capital gain that could be incurred by selling, and you do a refinance, if it's paid all the way off, you can unlock you know, up to 80-85% of that, the value in that property, tax free, and go.
You're better off most time refinance. I had one the other day. I've got a video. You may want to check it out, or your listeners. It's called the Burr Method on Overdrive. And what it is, I had 4 houses. It was 2 duplexes and 2 houses that were paid 90-something thousand on all 4 of them, and they were generating about $6,000 a month. Well, they were generating $4,000 a month, and I refinanced them, cashed out $168,000 after the tax. I mean, after the paying the property taxes, you know, whatever, and closing costs. Set them up on 15 years, and they still cash flowing positive cash. They were positive cash flowing 4,004, refinance over 4. Now they're still positive cash flowing over 2,000, and I cashed out $167,000.
Wow. Yeah, that's a wonderful way to unlock investment capital and move that capital to an area where it'll get a higher rate of return and really explode your portfolio. Well, Rick, this has been great, man. I appreciate you and your time and your story. I love it. I think it's a wonderful success story, and I thank you for sharing it with us.
Well, like I said, I hope I hadn't been all over the scope this
time. No, it's been great. It's been great.
Maybe I made sense. I get kind of, you know, I love talking about it, though, man. I appreciate you having me on here. And sure. I really do appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely. So take Rick's advice. Buy yourself some properties. Put them on autopilot. Get them paid off. Pay them down. Don't in a state of high emotions go run and sell them, because you hang on to them a long time, you could be in Rick's position one day where you've got 100 of these things paid off, nearly paid off, and created a lot of wealth for your family. They can really change a lot of lives. So this has been great, Rick. Thanks so much, man. I look forward to meeting you in person, and let's stay in touch. Yes,
sir. Okay, buddy. Can I tell you one more thing?
Okay, go for it.
Most folks, I always tell folks, people got to rent or buy or live under the bridge, and only so many can live under the bridge. So you got to always remember that. People going to rent or buy.
Absolutely. That's good. Yeah, you got to rent or buy. Might as well buy, and then you could, you know, if you want to move out of it, you could rent it to somebody else. So
that's right. Well, thank you so much, buddy.
Absolutely. All right, we'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Please connect with me on Instagram at Daily Real Estate Investor or via email at josiahsmelser@gmail.com. My new book titled Dream It and Build It: How to Crush Your Real Estate Investing Goals is out. You can get it either in digital or physical format on Amazon. Once you've read the book, please leave me a review. Tune in next time for another episode of The Daily Real Estate Investor as we both join in our financial freedom journey.